Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Monday night installment here at Your Remedy Is in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various offensive litigating strategies. This is with our speaker, Mr. David Merlin. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedy Is in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer.
Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedy Is in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless. It's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedy Is in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com, if we look in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure, better known to some as American jurisprudence or AMJUR. The rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes all of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course. So it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Although these items are very affordably priced, the jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedy Is in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of YourRemedyIsInTheLaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups that Your Remedy Is in the Law. And Your Remedy Is in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that altogether make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at YourRemedyIsInTheLaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict, pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you'll get to a point where it'll ask you, what are your hot points? What are you interested in? This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights. Anything that you can think of that if it affects your personal rights in one way or another, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together. Much of how you think of a social network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom. It's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. And maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do where I was really situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to a point where you've educated to yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hopefully you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, maybe you're just new to your remedies in the law and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number on the pin. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. Every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make at your remedies in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at your remedies in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that, honestly, most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. And we make those introductions. Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. The unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. Again, we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have had to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if your remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you call the web and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Well, Martin, thank you so very much for sharing that disclaimer with us. We appreciate that. For you on the call tonight, I want to remind you to please consider asking questions tonight when it opens up to Q&A. GW has been with us for a couple of years now and been faithful every week to be here, with a few exceptions when something came up, but he's been here very well every day, every week. And last time he was here a month ago, there were no questions. And the time before that, the week before that, there were no questions. So he decided, and rightly so, that he would turn the calls over to me for 3 weeks, and then he'd return to the last Monday of every month. And so the last Monday of December is Christmas Day, so we're not going to be having a call that day for sure. So it's not going to be till January before you'll hear from him again. If we don't have questions for him, he may very well say, look, just let me know when you have somebody that wants to talk to me and put me through to him. And so, you know, if you like, prefer what I've got to share with you with regards to the education, then that'll work out fine. If not, you know, it's going to be relatively sad to see him just not appear. Anyways, with that having been said, he'll be joining us very shortly. There was something that I wanted to share with you, if I may, until he comes into the call. See if I can find this real quick. It's not far away. There it is. So this is an article that was shared with me from a book, and I want to share it with you. It talks about dealing with the police. And so I'll read from this, and I will interject some comments with regards to why you're correcting your political citizenship status makes all the difference in the world. Quote, years ago, the police were your friend, and they were your defender. They were here to protect and serve. Things have changed now that the police forces have become commercial organizations dedicated to producing a profit by taking money from you in the form of speeding tickets, parking fines, and any other number of charges. It was stated on national TV recently that in the last 13 years, there have been 3,000 additional offenses that have been invented and put on the books. As each individual police force is a commercial enterprise, in the way like McDonald's restaurant is an enterprise, commercial, it has no authority to enforce anything any more than McDonald's does. The men and women who work under the banner of their local police force have two separate roles. When they take up their occupation, they take an oath of office, pledging to uphold the law. That oath, and nothing else, gives them the authority to act and enforce the American common law, that is, the few things that are listed near the start of any legal lease action. It does not authorize them to do anything connected with so-called governmental statutes that they have been so trained to use this legal lease to then entrap you, the uninformed members of the public, into. To be fair, it's highly likely that members of the police force were not even aware of what they're doing. Understand the difference between that which is a legal law, legal statute, and that which is a lawful law, and what are the requirements, how they apply, and are not. So let me just interject right here that if you are a federal citizen, which is a United States citizen, you are subject to the statutes. Anything you say with, any malum prohibitive laws they come up with, you've got to obey them. But your corrected political citizenship status converts you to only be exposed to what lawful law is on the books, which is very, very limited. You have to damage someone or their property in order to be charged with something under the American common law. Now, don't get me wrong. Most policemen and women do a great job and assist members of the public, often above and beyond the requirements of their job, intimidation of fraud and opposing bullying and whatever else, and they comfort those who are bereaved and injured. Those are all nice things that they do. Admittedly, the commercial companies who control the police forces are working hard to end this sort of positive behavior using ridiculous health and safety regulations as an excuse, even to the extent that police officers are instructed to stand by and watch somebody drown and not attempt to save them. This is not the choice of the officer, but rather the instructions of the owners of the company. Because these thousands of invented offenses do not apply to anybody unless they agree to be bound by them, and agreeing to be a U.S. citizen is one of those agreements, it becomes essential for police officers to, and possibly inadvertently, persuade a member of the public to agree to subject themselves to these unnecessary restrictions and agree to pay invented cash penalties to the local commercial company called the police force or law enforcement. The normal first attempt to establish the spurious dominance of the police officer is by asking you for your name. This is not an innocent question, and it essentially is there that if you're careful on what you say, these are legal lease booby traps that are placed in front of you. One suitable reply might be, quote, the law does not require me to provide that information, end quote, which is entirely correct and avoids pitfalls, number one, and no matter how often the question is asked, the answer is always the same. It's important not to argue with a police officer, as that is another legally booby trap, which makes you subject to the thousands of hateful regulations designed to part you with your money. So only answer questions ideally with a non-aggressive question and don't volunteer any information. If a police officer says something like, you were exceeding the speed limit, you might reply with, oh, was I? You don't argue with them, nor do you say that the common law does not apply to or require you to keep within the speed limits or obey road signs. You don't go into any of that, even though it is perfectly true. Just remember one maxim is that arguments are for the fools. As mentioned before, if the police officer asks, do you understand? Your request should be no, I do not understand. As before, the question is a legal lease trap and has nothing whatsoever to do with understanding anything said. Under common law, American common law, an offense has only been committed if there is a victim. Somebody who has been injured or killed, had possession of damaged or stolen goods, or who had been defrauded. So if the police officer keeps pushing you to agree to pay his company money when you don't need to, then a good question to ask might be, well, who is the victim, officer? An alternative question to ask might be, what is the charge, or am I free to go? If you simply stick to these questions, when the police officer has nothing to work on, as you have not agreed to be bound by statutes, you have not provided a name and an address for him to write down on his invoice, or fixed penalty notice. You have not entered into a controversy by arguing with him and or have placed yourself in dishonor by refusing him point blank. There is one other thing, and that is without being aggressive or offensive in any way, you must not do anything which he tells you to do, because if you do, then those charming legalese people can see that you're agreeing to stand under them and become subject to his legal but not lawful authority, and so become a liability to those thousands of cunning plans called statutes you carefully have been crafted against you to rob you. And it's a perfect legal but not lawful way to operate. I think I heard GW join us. Yes, he did. Hello,
yep,
GW. All right. Well, just one more paragraph to finish here. One thing which any police officer needs to become aware of is the fact that they do not have any security provided by the police force which employs them. In any situation which does not involve the American common law, the police officer is acting on his own, acting as an individual contractor, and as such is wide open to action against him under either the American common law, unlawfully, or by civil court actions if his actions warrant it. If there is a failure to establish this joinder, which is where a man voluntarily agrees to become this federal citizen or to be acknowledged as one, then the authority of the police officer just simply does not exist in any respect. And when they cross that line, you have Title 42, Section 1981, 1983, 1985, and 1986 in civil matters, and in Title 18, Section 242 in criminal matters of deprivation of rights under color of law. So without any further, and we'll go into this deeper on tomorrow night's call with John. So without any further ado, it's my sincere pleasure to bring GW to the forefront. It's been a while, guy. It's been, what, 3 weeks now? We've missed you. What's going on?
Well, been busy. Busy doing all kinds of stuff. So, yeah. And a number of people out traveling to different destinations to get their passport and their passport cards done. It's getting a little tedious right now because of all the influx of people that are getting things done at the State Department. So just gotta sometimes it takes calling a few times to get that appointment, and sometimes it doesn't happen right away, but people prevail when they just keep on trying and have some patience. And so got a guy over and just flew into San Diego and from out of the country to get his passport card done. Actually, he's doing a little trial run for me and getting a duplicate, which I didn't even know you could do until he explained it to me. He's done it forever with every passport he's had. So, and that's really only, and it's something I'm entertaining just because I would like to know the process, but it's not something that most people would be even needing. This is probably more set towards people that are going to try for numerous different visas and things like that when they're in foreign countries. And in one of the processes you have to do in a foreign country is you have to turn in your passport to get your visa. And then during that time period that they're going through that process to stamp the passport with a visa in it by the department, they're out of their ID for the time being. And sometimes that's a little too much for some people, so they want to second passport, just be able to rely on that while they're doing their daily routines in a foreign country. So that's what's going on with me. And other than that, it's things are bubbling all over the place. There's all kinds of stuff happening with challenges on the legal side from people that have been clients and whatnot, and we're getting stuff done with, and it seems like there's no there's no reprieve from that. It seems like as long as this administration is in place that we have right now, it's going to be a challenge on a number of different fronts all the time. So, but there are good remedies out there. And I know that Michael and his team have a number of those remedies. So that's good to know for people that are on the call that have certain situations and some extreme pressures coming against them, that there's a place they can go. So with that said, I don't know if we've got some new people on the line or people that want to ask questions or people that want to understand what we're talking about, of course, on this call, which mainly it's about correcting your status and putting you in a category for putting you in a category of being an unfranchised individual or an American national, okay, as some people state as a state citizen, which is also not wrong to state, it's just that you can't find that term most of the time in their literature, other than American national, which is pretty buried. We do it through a process of a new application for a brand new passport, because you cannot correct an existing passport. You can't correct the information on an existing passport. That's at least the rules of the State Department. So we have to abide by their rules, and when we do it, we go for a brand new, spanking new passport and with new information. It's just categorized in a different way along with an affidavit. And we get that done and get a brand new passport and passport card that we teach our people to use in not just for traveling on airlines, but we also use the card, which is the same size as a driver's license, and we use that in situations where they want to interview you and stop you along the side of the road in an automobile or a vehicle, whatever you want to call it. But in those situations, we like to use the card, because the card is refers to the fact that you're traveling and not driving, which is a commercially regulated activity. And so those are some of the things that we're talking about and on this call, and we help people to do. So if there's questions, Martin on the line?
His cats died about an hour ago, and he has to deal with his wife on it. Anyways, press star 2 on your keypad, ladies and gentlemen, to raise your hands. Press star 2 to raise your hand. For those of you on Freedom's Radio, look to the center right of your monitor. You'll see the silhouette of a rectangle laying on its side. It's empty on the inside. Type away, just left-click inside of it. Type away your comment or your question, and I'll be glad to lend my voice to your comment or your question. Before we go to Bill in Tennessee and then Ron up in Massachusetts, I did want to ask you if you have an update on the people that you're communicating with, dealing with, working with regarding the bank, the banking company that has a pre-1933 license.
Yeah. It's interesting. Been a lot of activity lately, and it seems like it's gone from me being just kind of the person that came in to structure both sides of the aisle, and that's one of the sides of the aisle is the man that actually has that's holding the original banking charter. And by the way, that banking charter, The bank was formed in 1917 and operated up through 1933 with top ratings and good success. And then in 1933, the FDIC was formed and started forcing all the banks to have insurance. But the people that were holding this bank and had put together the charter, they were pioneers and founders of the bank, and they said, no way. They said, we've operated successfully for years without insurance, and we will not be forced to start now. So what they ostensibly did is they closed the bank down voluntarily, liquidated all the assets, paid off all the depositors, and they retained the bank charter. This was right here. This is kind of an historical event because most every single bank that you can think of acquiesced and took the FDIC insurance, and of course a lot of them did fail. And then once they fail, that charter cannot be retained by the original owners once they fail. And so this one's grandfathered in a very special way, so that not only did they not acquiesce, but they were able to retain it fully. And that was legal back then. It says, and after all the banks were insured, you could no longer close a bank and retain its charter. So what the owner of this charter that's been holding it for 50 years says is it's now the only bank in history that anybody knows of that has done this. Then at the end of 50 years duration of this bank, the founders went to their close friend. This happened approximately in the 1970-71 era. The founders went to their close friend, who happened to be the governor, and had the bank permanently filed with perpetual existence. So it's got a perpetual life as a metals bank, dealing in gold and silver and all other precious metals. And then, now all new banks have to operate under the current laws of the Banking Commission. But this bank is different. It's great. It's a great grandfather charter, pre-1933 and pre-1971 legislation. There's two separate pieces of legislation that really affect it. One was in 33, and one was in 1971. And I think that correlates the 71. I think correlates with some. I have a sneaking suspicion with the what happened with the silver. Okay. The bank's now over 100 years old and has a unique and extensive grandfather powers, and it's the only one that's like it in its existence. So, it's pretty interesting. We've had approximately about 19 different groups come through that were trying to get vetted and buy the bank retain its charter and operate and get started. But everybody's failed so far. One of the things is they have to, of course, come here. They've got to come to the United States, whoever wants it. You have to meet in Vegas, and that's where you can see all the instruments, the charter, the whole bit. You can't be looking at it because of the laws. You can't be looking at it outside of the particular jurisdiction of Vegas. And so...
No, go ahead. Okay. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Okay. So, it's kind of an interesting thing for me because I watched them kind of flounder around with all these different groups, and now I've gotten involved more in a proactive state. So, doing some vetting of some different organizations now. And so we know it's gonna happen pretty soon. I mean, there's it's really strange. Hardly any of the people that have come forward have dropped out. They're all still really kind of a funny scenario. They're all still kind of trying. But a lot of these groups are foreign money that is trying to be, trying to repatriate at least or get it onto U.S. soil into a banking institution here. And it's been a big problem for them. And on top of that, there's other things that play in. We've found out that, some of them are, a lot of them are just brokers, and they're looking for things like, they think I don't want to be nasty in any way, but they're influenced by some of the same influences that influence maybe could be a number of people on this call, but thinking that, certain currencies are going to revalue right now or next week, or, it's just about done. It's going to be right now. Anyway, I've been hearing that for 14 years. And so some of these folks are of the same, I don't want to say ilk, but the same influence. And so, that's a situation that doesn't write itself. But things are moving forward. Got a lot of stuff happening this week. So,
are there any discussions about brick and mortar buildings, them actually going live with it?
Oh yeah, yeah. In fact, the brick and mortar. There's two separate charters, and one of the buildings that's being saved back is a building right in the middle of Vegas that was built by Howard Hughes. And it's a beautiful, gorgeous, ornate building that has, overly with the wood and in every single office. And the thing is, this building has just about everywhere has vaults, big, huge vaults for, and it has very, very, 4 foot thick concrete walls with bulletproof glass, huge, huge, big windows, bulletproof glass, and all kinds of stuff. But that's one of the buildings that's going to be used for one of the charters.
So, would it be safe to say that, generally speaking, sometime in 2024? Sometime in 2024, they'll have business. You think so?
Yeah.
Super.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'd be really curious how they can interface what they're doing mm-hmm. with the, Kazarian banking system that we have.
Well, here's the thing.
Anyway.
This bank does not have to succumb to the FDIC insurance. In fact, that's one of the things that we're trying to vet with people coming in is that it's not recommended to do the FDIC insurance in operating a private bank like this, but especially this
right.
one. This is it could be very, very, very interesting. I would encourage people to not only that bank, when it finally comes online and everything else, but there are other institutions that seem to be not they're FDIC insured and things like that, but they seem to have more of a patriotic bent to them, like Old Glory Bank. I don't know if anybody on the line has heard that. I've talked about it many times. Old Glory Bank, that you can just get there by typing in old and then glory and then bank.com. And it's all online. They're in Oklahoma, and they are the thing about them is they say you can't be you really can't be canceled at their bank for your political beliefs. So that's their statement. And I would
unfortunately that bank won't open up trust accounts.
I just had one of my clients open up a trust account at that bank with his charitable religious trust, all online.
Oh, then they've changed it. Great, great. I'll let Chris Ann know.
And Hash Slavin has opened up an account there for one of his clients. they're supposedly fully operational now.
Fantastic! Yeah. I'm excited to hear that. Excited to hear that. All right.
Cool.
Yeah. Let's go ahead and open it up for Q&A. We'll start with Ron in Massachusetts. Go ahead, Ron.
Hey, it's Axel. How are you?
Doing great.
Hey, GW, what's the length of time this generally takes from the time you receive the money?
To go through the correction process?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm not sure how Mike or Michael is doing it right now, but normally the people that I take through, if they want to get it done fast, they can get it done within a week or so.
Oh, wow.
And have it in hand. I don't take anybody through the process of going through the post office anymore. We were doing that early on, but I got away from that quite a little while back. We now, when we take somebody through it, or at least I do, I'm not sure, Michael, I haven't heard you speak about this, but now I take everybody through calling the U.S. State Department. It's a special 1-800 number that has a list of all the different available appointments, okay, at every single State Department facility that there is in the country. And the reason we do this is because when we get that appointment to go into the State Department, the thing that triggers that appointment is the fact that you have a ticket. You're just telling them this. You have a ticket to fly out of the country in less than 14 days. And so we don't need any validation of that process. We don't need to validate at that time on the phone. We just need to tell them that, and that's what triggers the appointment to get in and get your appointment at that facility. Once we get the appointment at the facility and all your paperwork is in line, you got your affidavit, your paperwork, and it's all been approved, then once you get in there, I have my people, any one of two websites I have them go to. One's called an Onward Ticket. And that process allows you to get a ticket that will pass muster, okay? And it only costs you between 12 and 16 bucks. And it's a throwaway. Mm-hmm. And lots of people use this for getting visas, okay? That's what it's used for most of the time because they don't want to get a real ticket. They want to get their visa, and then they want it more relaxed. But to get a visa, you got to have a ticket, okay? And so this allows us to get that ticket for the next day, for the very next day after the appointment, so that it gives the State Department no wiggle room. When you show up there, and you're saying, hey, I'm going out of the – yeah, my ticket, I leave tomorrow. So they can't say, well, we're going to send you your – sometimes they'll say that. Or come back in 72 hours. And so this gives them no wiggle room. They got to get it to you within 3 hours or so. And we've been getting it every time. Now, you don't get your card at all facilities every time. They mail that to you, and it usually takes about 10 days. But most facilities will give you the card the same day, but some don't. But you still get it, okay? It's just that the main thing is you get your passport that very same day. And the other part of that is that what's nice about that is that everything, as far as the rules inside the State Department are concerned, that when you go through that process, that fast process, urgent process, and you put in your paperwork, they must take that paperwork and upload everything up on the screens immediately in real time. And so the affidavits get uploaded into the system in real time. They don't have to go to a special room somewhere and be uploaded into the file later on, maybe 2 years later, okay? All they have to do is upload it in real time. And so that's one of the reasons why I converted over to that with the, getting some good counsel from somebody that deals with the State Department on a pretty regular basis. And so awesome. I was like, okay. So does that help?
So, yeah. And about this appointment, is this over the phone, physical?
Meeting? No. No, it's physical, face to face. Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
All right. And I'm just looking at my notes here. Chicken scratch. Is it like a real estate license? Like if I fail the first time, I get to take it again?
It depends on what you fail on.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
So I've had people do some really, nonsensical stuff that they were told not to do. For one thing, if you try to go into that process and you're like a lot of people, and I get this all the time, you know, they're reading all these different gurus on all these different websites about the state national process and about doing it, and they hear, oh, yeah, I can just put 0000, you know, 0000000000 in my Social Security number area, and that's the way to do it because I saw it on this website. And then they'll hear, well, of course, you know, you could do that because it's illegal for them to require the Social Security number. And, of course, we have different legislation and things that we can quote. The problem, let me tell you the problem with that is that if you do that and you tell them that you don't have a Social Security number, okay, they will look it up really fast. And they will get it. And they will show it to you. And then you're not only can you not come back right away, but it's a year until you can reapply. And the thing is, they've made it, this is inside the system, okay, and I officially don't know this, but inside the system, they've told their administrators that you let anybody go through without putting their Social Security number on there, we will charge you $10,000. Now, can you imagine the kind of angst that causes? So right. If you're thinking they're just being hostile to you because they, they're just Nazis, nah, not quite. These are high, you know, not real high paid, but they're medium paid slaves. And if they want their paycheck and be in good standing, they got to, you know, enforce the rules of where they work. So anyway, that's one thing that you don't want to do, okay? Many people have tried it and used to work in the past, but that all came to a screaming halt about 3 years ago. Yeah.
Is it still $7,500 if I remember correctly?
No, it's $5,000.
$5,000?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, $7,500 is Mr. Slevin's LLC.
Okay. All right. And what else? I think that's it. Is it more of a verbal or a written test or a conversation?
Well, it's not really. It's not a test. Okay, what you're doing is you're going in and getting an appointment, and they're going over your paperwork, your application, and they just have to make sure that everything's right. They have to make sure you're you. They got to ask you for your ID, you know, which you'll present to them. And most of the time, most people have a previous or not even expired passport, which also is ID. So they just have to verify it's you. They have to see you sign it in front of them. You have to sign the application. You never sign it before they ask you to sign it because the administrator has to witness it. And then, of course, you have to pay them whatever, you know, it's right around $200 for everything. And once that's done, they take your paperwork, and then they give you tell you to keep your phone on and to take a, you know, a call coming from a private number, because they'll usually tell you a time, but they'll also say, hey, we'll call you when it's time for you to come to the front of the line. And it just depends on the agency which one they do, give you a time or call you. And so it's not really a test, okay? Although there's things that we prep you on, okay, because they will kind of they will tell you things that are not quite correct, and so those are all the little things that we counter in the actual time that we're talking with them. So, you know, there's just a couple little things like that.
That's so cool. You took a load of pressure off me. Thank you. So,
okay.
All right, listen, I appreciate you, man. Thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, thank you. Listen, I wanted to expand on one thing. This unique immigration office where they actually produce the passport and the pass card in most cases is usually like one in a state. Here in Florida,
right,
the immigration office is in Miami. I'm up here near Jacksonville, north end of Florida. So it's like one-way drive is like almost 400 miles from where I am to where they are. So when you go through the original process, it was anywhere from 3 weeks to 3 months to get your paperwork accomplished. And but if you want to do this in one day, you're welcome to. I just need to understand that you have to identify where this office is and where it is in relationship to you, and you have to make your trip there. That's all. Just to let you know.
Right. So if I'm up in Mass, so I'd have to come down to Miami. Am I hearing that correctly?
No. Every state has at least one office. Yours is probably
every state has. Yeah. My clients, for some reason, tend to fly around a lot. And I pull from some interesting places. And so, a lot of times they're so used to flying that they'll, you know, it's no big deal to them. So they'll fly into a different, like this guy, he just flew from, I don't know, he was all over the place, Monaco and all these different places. And he just flew into San Diego because he found that San Diego had an open, you know, appointment. I've had another guy, Michael Koff, you know, should say names too much. He flew from Europe and ended up flying to Tennessee, couldn't find any place there, and had to go to Colorado.
Wow. Secret flyer miles.
Yeah. Yeah. No. It's just, you know, it's just one of those things. If you just keep on, but I've had people also that are not into flying that much, and they just keep on calling and keep on calling, and then boom, they get that appointment, they get an opening.
Right.
So I'm not really concerned with the appointment, just the fact that just getting it done. I don't mind waiting. You know, I'm pretty patient.
Sure.
But so it's pretty simple then. You're just going to prep me, and then I would just get myself to Boston probably.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
That's cool. That's cool. Listen, I appreciate your time, guys. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ron.
You're
welcome. Thank you very much. All right, next is Duncan. Duncan, go ahead.
Hello. Thank you, everyone. Hello.
Hello, Duncan.
Welcome.
GW, I'm not sure if this is exactly, you know, what you, you know, my question is, but for example, if you do not have your status corrected, you're still considered a private citizen. And so my thinking is, as a private citizen, I guess the question is, as a private citizen, you still have constitutional rights. Does that sound
nope.
right?
Nope.
Well,
nope.
You know, Michael's just going to come right straight out and say nope.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.